Hello, good evening, and welcome to the first episode of Season 4 of the Ubuntu UK podcast. It's Tuesday, the 1st of March 2011, and in this episode we're going to discuss whether free software can ever be the next big thing, and feature our first Ubuntu UK podcast quiz. We will of course cover the latest news, events, a bit about Ubuntu, command line love, and go over your feedback. I'm Tony, and with me this week is four of us here today. Laura, how are you?
Hello, I'm fine, thank you.
And who are you, Laura?
I'm a software engineer and I work in user experience on middleware.
That sounds very exciting.
I'm also a PhD student doing a psychology in home automation technology.
Excellent.
Research.
That sounds more exciting. Also here this evening is Alan. How are you doing?
Hello, not bad at all.
Excellent. How are you? And you do what? Who are you? Why are you here?
Who are you?
My name's Alan. I'm an IT contractor, mainly working in SAP. I'm active in the community side of Ubuntu. I'm not a developer, but I'm on things like the community council, local council, and membership board, that kind of stuff.
You get to approve if people become Ubuntu members, is that right?
I'm one of the
one
many
of the people.
Yes.
not just other ones.
It's not just me. Don't worry.
Catch you on a good day. And finally, but last but not definitely not least, it's Mark, who's joining us as a regular presenter for the first time here on the show.
Brilliant. Hello.
Hello.
And I sound too enthusiastic.
Yeah, brilliant. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Excellent. And what do you do?
I'm a web developer. I work mainly on a project called Moodle, which is a virtual learning environment for colleges, universities, training organizations, and so on.
Excellent.
And I'm also the show's obligatory bearded presenter.
Yes, that's true. You do
taking have... over from Laura.
Thanks, Alan.
Yeah, that's just harsh. Yeah, and I'm Tony, and I'm an IT manager at a college by day, and in the evening and at night and at weekends and stuff, I'm a bit of a photo geek and a media geek on Linux, really. A bit of a system administrator, and try to keep everything working, and hopefully the reason why you can hear this.
Or not.
Or not, but you'll never know if you can't. Yeah, and so we're back for our fourth season, and we've got a fantastic new website.
Yes.
Which is thanks both to Mark in his capacity as our unofficial web designer and one of our listeners, Andrew Higginson,
who
a little while ago emailed in a design to us and said, I think your website could look like this. It would be a lot better.
Yeah,
yes, you're right.
First of all, sent us a mock-up, just an image of what it should look like. And we said, yeah, that looks lovely. And then a little while later, he said, oh, I've done it in CSS and HTML, and he's actually sent us all the code.
So I basically copied and pasted what he did into our website. Yeah. It looks lovely.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
All new branding and everything.
Yeah.
Excellent. Well, I suppose it's time for us to get on with it.
Over the past few years, the free software community has produced some really exciting projects. They allow us to connect our lives together, sharing information, pictures, messages, and even just plain old data, while respecting our freedoms and ensuring that we retain control. However, many of the projects we hear about most, such as Mono, StatusNet, and Migo, all emulate existing proprietary products and platforms that have already received mass market buy-in. Is there something intrinsic about free software that leaves us destined to just create freer versions of what already exists? Can a free software project get the marketing and media attention it needs to make it the next big thing before a proprietary company gets there first? And will free software solutions always be destined to be second best amongst the public at large, but better from a geek perspective?
Yeah. I'm sitting here trying to think of things that came first in free software.
Well, that was when I was thinking of this discussion. This was like one of my main gripes. I mean, we have all of this really cool stuff that's coming along, like Diaspora and, you know, Identica. And in many ways, they are, or at least designed to be, better than... sorry, you've got an example that I can see you're dying to give.
Wobbly Windows.
Wobbly Windows.
Did we have that? Yeah, we had that first.
Yeah, we did have that
first. Red
Hat.
But then, sorry, go on.
I suppose so, but then I'm not sure that Wobbly Windows ever became the next big thing because it never really made its way across to the other products and is something that now everyone uses.
Well, it is in that Wobbly Windows was just a way of demonstrating that you've got this composited desktop, because nobody ever had that before. Nobody ever had a thing where you could rotate the desktop and zoom in and out whilst the video is playing and you're typing a document. Whether you'd actually want to do that is arguable, but it was a demonstration that the technology was there and we could do it. And it was a great demonstration because it was visual, and you know, and someone could just, you know, press a few buttons on their keyboard and suddenly their windows were wobbling around all over the place. In fact, my boss at work, that's the one thing he does. He enables first when he puts Ubuntu on a machine. He goes, oh, when he looks at mine, he says, you haven't got wobbly windows, as if that's some kind of, you know, massive drawback on my machine. So I think you can class that as something we got first. But then you look at the Mac and Windows, they both now got the 3D-ish stuff.
Tabs in browsers.
Yeah, no, actually, to be fair, yeah, Firefox is a big win from this point of view. But then it's, I suppose it's sort of, no, sorry, oh, that was a terrible point I was about to make. I'm going to abandon that one before I go.
Well, well recovered. One of the things that I think we are pretty good at are things like drivers.
Yes.
And hardware. And we were the first for USB 2 drivers. And I think we were the
Bluetooth,
and USB
3
drivers.
And yeah, USB 3 and Bluetooth and stuff, and SATA and all that sort of stuff was in the Linux kernel first. But of course, nobody really notices that stuff. And nobody really kind of has the hardware to use it in the very early days anyway.
Yeah, but the we were first with USB is massively outweighed by the bazillion USB devices that don't work or you know, didn't work straight away.
We were first with USB, just don't try to use an ATI graphics card.
just don't plug anything into it.
Netbooks?
Yeah,
that's more of a hardware thing, really.
Networks,
it's more of a configuration. Really.
Okay, so lightweight operating systems we're good at.
Yeah.
But then other people do that in the embedded market. There are other companies like QNX, for example, which is now the operating system that the new BlackBerry tablet is based on, is QNX. And that's non-free. And they've been doing very lightweight desktops, like on a floppy disk. I remember downloading one way before I even looked at Linux. So there are people, that's a specialist one that maybe most of us wouldn't have heard of.
But I think the thing with the hardware is quite interesting, because a single free software developer sat at home could come up with a fantastic piece of free software and distribute it, and it could be really, really good. But we can, it's a lot more difficult to become really innovative and trendsetting in the hardware field, because you need to have a manufacturer who's got a hardware plant behind them in order to be able to do that. So if you're Apple and you've got your hardware manufacturing plant in China, you can, you know, develop your hardware and your software hand in hand, and it works really well together. But the risk factor for from hardware manufacturers to say, yes, I'm going to put some obscure version of Linux on my piece of hardware is a lot greater, it seems.
Isn't that, I mean, I guess you're referring to like the very first netbooks and those that had Linux.
That was a bit of an exception, wasn't it, really?
Because, well, mainly because there wasn't anything else that would run on it. I mean, the original EEE PC had a 2 gig flash drive. It was like tiny.
But the EPCs came about because of the One Laptop Per Child project, which was free. And they came up with cool things like the monitor screen that displays in bright sunlight. And they had low-powered wireless cards, I think. And I mean, that was incredible from a hardware point of view. I don't know whether the software was especially innovative. I mean, they did the different UI, but that may not have taken off outside of...
And that was based on free software. I mean, there's Fedora underneath it, isn't there? But that... See, that's a special case as well, because One Laptop Per Child was, you know, a humongous foundation that was started by someone who had a vision and managed to get investment to create this fantastic hardware product.
But then with software, unless it's a web-based thing, which isn't technically free ever, if it's a cloud type of thing, you could argue, then it's always going to be something that needs money behind it.
I don't know. Well, yeah, okay. So you look at the big ones that we've got so far: OLPC, Firefox, Mozilla Foundation, based on stuff they got from Netscape, based on stuff they got from Mosaic.
But Windows and Mac came out of Xerox. You know, you can always trace it back to something else.
And there's a good argument that Linux, the platform that is a significant chunk of the picture we're talking about, is a derivative anyway of old-style Unix and BSD, and go back far enough, you know, you reach the old proprietary system, five Unix systems. And so where's the innovation in that? It's actually aping an old system.
It's building on and making it accessible, isn't it?
So of the examples that you gave in your intro, you've mentioned Mono, States.net, Amigo, emulate proprietary products. Is that such a bad thing that we're aping what
No,
other people
I don't think it's a bad thing that we're just I don't think the fact that we're emulating them or taking what they do and making a free version of it, I don't think that's a bad thing at all. What I am finding frustrating is the fact that, for instance, Migo is, it's Debian on your phone or your tablet, basically, right, with a nice interface on top. And I love that because I love that, people actually have a full-blown Linux system in their pocket, but they've already got iPhones or Android phones. So why would they be looking at Migo phones? And they've already got a Facebook account, so why would they be looking at setting up a diaspora seed or joining someone else's?
I think, there's a couple of reasons. One is, some people are obsessive about the freedom. You've got someone at one end of the scale, you've got Richard Stallman, who has a laptop which is free BIOS, free software, completely top to bottom, end to end, doesn't touch anything non-free. And so he's the kind of person who wouldn't touch Facebook.
And at the other end, we've got you. with your MacBook on your back.
Thanks for that. And a myriad of people in between.
Yes.
And people will, choose a platform not just based on freedom, but features as well. And so some people might say, well, Diaspora isn't attractive to me whilst, it's free software, but there's nothing compelling in there.
But, for instance, Identica, for a long time, before the new Twitter, as it was, came along, Identica had a lot of features which Twitter didn't, like embedding images and videos in your posts, tweets, dents, whatever they call them.
And groups
and all sorts of stuff like that. But despite all of these features and the fact, on top of that, that it was free and you distributed, you could set up your own instance of it and federate it, people didn't go for Identica because Twitter existed first.
Well, it depends what your definition of people is. Some people will.
Well, the mass market didn't.
Do we care? Some people will say, why should you care if the whole mass market uses Twitter or not? The same way as some people would argue that there's, some people, for example, would argue that they don't want Fedora to be used by end users. Some would say it's a developer platform. It's not aimed at in inverted commas, normal people.
Okay, the reason that I care is because if I want to interact with people who use devices or systems, the easiest way to do that is for me to use the same system as them. And I'd like them to all be using a nice free system so I can use a nice free system. And so I don't have to have a Facebook account and I don't have to have a Twitter account. I can have an account on these free systems and everyone else is there already.
But this has been going on for years. You could be using...
this is my point, that it's been going on for
years.
That
it doesn't get any better.
No. I don't. I mean, separate from the free software argument, you could be using... One person's using WordPerfect and someone else is using Word. Two different file formats, two completely different platforms. And the only way to get everyone talking to each other in terms of documents, I send you my CV, you can't open it, I have to use the same software as you, is for everyone to be using the same thing. So and then you get a market where everyone's using the same thing. Not because it's the best thing, but because the first thing that had huge market adoption is the one that everyone uses, and it becomes a de facto standard.
But the point is, that's never free software.
Yeah.
Oh, it hasn't been historically.
It hasn't been historically.
Yeah, I'm finding it hard to think of any.
Yeah.
I can't predict into the future, so it has to be historically.
Yeah, at the moment, the document standard is Microsoft Office. It's not LibreOffice or OpenOffice or whatever. It's not, Open Document. It's not Open Document, it's Microsoft Office.
But isn't this something we just have to live with, the fact that there is diversity and the fact that, someone's written a program in one language, therefore they need this compiler, or they've written a document in this, so they need that application.
It's not about the diversity, it's about the fact that the one that wins is never free software, and it's just the point of what Mark was saying.
But what's your definition of winner?
Well, it's the one that your mum uses without being told by you, because a friend's recommended it.
The one I have to use because everyone else does. That's the one that's won.
Or the one that you just use because everybody else uses it and that's what you've heard is good and stuff. Rather than people talking about Photoshop and then having to go and find the GIMP.
I think that's a limited definition of winner because...
I think it's quite a mainstream definition of winner.
Okay, but what about the fact that from my mum's point of view, right now, she's a winner because she's using software that she never has viruses on. She never has to phone anyone for support, almost never has to phone anyone for support. And it just works.
Yeah, I'm not knocking the quality of the software. It's the fact that...
No, I'm not saying you are.
The majority of the country isn't using that and saying how brilliant it is because I don't have viruses anymore. They still use Windows or whatever.
But that's what I'm saying. That's what I'm saying. The definition of winner is, are you talking mass market adoption?
Yeah.
That means win. Or is it just the individual being empowered to do what they want to do? My mum is empowered to do what she wants to do at almost no cost, and she's a winner.
But get that message across to the rest of the country. And yeah, that's mass market adoption and winner in this sense, yeah.
Hmm. There are two different definitions of winner, clearly.
The point of what Mark was saying is he wants free software to be the leader in something, and it's not. And the point where I thought it could be, like it could progress that way, was when we were having that buttons discussion. Because Mark was saying he wanted the buttons on the other side because he wanted to do something innovative with the buttons set, the old button side. And that's kind of gone quiet.
Right.
Well,
and Matt got there first anyway.
One of the things that some of the people are pointing out in the IRC channel, /Ubuntu-UK-podcast on the Freenode IRC network.
Enough dashes in that.
Quite a lot of dashes. They're talking about how often the open source alternative or the open source equivalent of a particular package maybe were the better one. And because it's perhaps not got the publicity, people aren't advertising their open source project in the same way as, say, Microsoft advertised Windows 7 in train stations. It has time to nurture and develop and become something that's really reliable out of the public gaze, which then helps adoption further down the line. I think Firefox is a good example of that. And whether that is just a happy coincidence, really. If free software is being developed in, under the spotlight of mass market adoption that, say, Windows is or Office is or Mac OS is, whether it would... have the same quality that it eventually does anyway.
But then I suppose further down the line it might be less relevant anyway because something else has already got the mass market appeal. Although to be fair, Firefox was the exception to the rule there because it stole the mass market appeal from Internet Explorer.
Yeah.
And the other thing that Firefox had, which a lot of these other projects didn't have, was a lot of marketing. And a lot of that was grassroots marketing as well.
Yeah
true.
Well, that's all very good. I'm not sure whether we've reached any conclusions, but if you've got any feedback and you'd like to send it in, email podcast@ubuntu-uk.org or send us any feedback via all the other methods that are listed on the website, and we'll read some of them out in the next episode.
And now it's time for some news and events. Dissatisfied developers at the FFmpeg project, which enables audio and video playing in many open source multimedia applications, have pretty much staged a coup. Unhappy with the project management style of lead maintainer Michael Niedermeyer, they've moved all the code to a new repository and updated all documentation to remove mention of his name. Seems a bit harsh.
That's a good thing, though, isn't it? If he was a blocker or he was a problem, you work around it. That's what open source does. That's what the internet does. It works around a problem.
Yeah, true. And it's not the first project to split over a particular individual.
No.
Good luck to them.
Nokia have announced a reorganization that includes partnering with Microsoft to build a new global mobile ecosystem.
Ooh.
Which means using Windows Platform as its primary mobile operating system instead of Symbian. Migo will apparently become an open source mobile operating system project, and Nokia still plans to ship a Migo-based device later in the year.
Note, a Migo-based device.
Yeah.
Bye-bye, Linux. Bye-bye, open source. Hello, Windows 7.
Yeah. And although that said, Intel have still said that they are still strongly behind Migo, and it does still have the Linux Foundation and other people.
Also, Nokia own Qt,
the
graphical development environment used by KDE.
Yes.
So I wonder what the future holds for that. Pure speculation. Google's efforts to establish a standard, high-quality, open video format for the web that is freely available to everyone has hit a hurdle. MPEG LA is an organisation that licenses video-related patents, and they've requested patent holders to inform them of patents they believe Google's format uses. Can I say patents anymore in that? W3C, the web standards organisation, won't approve a standard that includes requirements to license patents in order to use it. apparently I can.
Well, that's annoying.
And yeah. It's kind of not. So this is the whole thing. When people keep saying that, you know, such and such a format is free, and, you know, we get, you know, emails from people telling us we shouldn't be using MP3, we should be using OGG because it's not encumbered by a patent. How can you possibly know? Because people like MPEG-LA and other companies out there have huge libraries of patents. There's, you know, yeah, they could jump out at any time and say, we own that.
Indeed.
The German Foreign Office has dropped Linux on its desktops and reverted back to Windows XP. Crikey. They've reportedly gone with Windows XP as a stepping stone onward to Windows 7. This is despite positive audits for the Linux desktop strategy by respected business consultancy McKinsey.
Is this another we'll switch to Linux and then get a massive discount from Microsoft to go?
Well,
back
they
to
were
Windows.
Several years down their project and they actually had deployed it. Mm. So,
but they were saying they had people complaining about the desktop and the applications weren't available.
Yeah, couldn't do certain things. But it got a good audit, as Mark said in the piece. You know, the people who were looking at it from externally seemed quite happy with it. But I guess if you haven't got your users on board, you're still scuppered.
LibreOffice 3.3.1 has been released with fixes for bugs and crashes on Windows, Linux and Mac. And colourful icons, apparently.
Yeah, nice. It's pretty.
Oh, the icons are colourful. Excellent.
I've never used LibreOffice yet.
I'll switch today.
I've installed it, I launched it and it looked like OpenOffice.
With colourful icons?
I don't think I had the colourful icons.
On all my machines, I switched from OpenOffice. The ones where that are not Ubuntu, I switched from OpenOffice to LibreOffice. And when you uninstall OpenOffice, it pops up a browser with a survey in it that asks you why you're leaving OpenOffice. There's a little box at the bottom where you can fill in anything you like. So I put something appropriate there for Oracle.
Saying thank you for all your effort, Oracle, over the years.
Yeah, something like that.
Thanks for buying, son. Excellent. Well, that's all of the news. So we've now got some events to tell you about. And the first one, which I am just going to queue up, is for a U-Cubed event in Manchester, a Mad Lab, which is the second one of these. There was one last year, wasn't there?
Yep.
This is on the 2nd of April, and we've got this promo to pay.
U-Cubed is a great new event in Manchester, England. It brings together the Debian and Ubuntu communities to share ideas and knowledge.
We'll be hosting talks and workshops on various topics, such as Ubuntu Debian bug reporting,
package management,
and many more topics.
Our next event will be on the 2nd of April at MadLab in Manchester. And more details can be found at our website at ucubed.info.
Try it yourself.
You'll see.
But don't take it from us.
Don't take it from me.
That was from John, the nice guy Spriggs, among other people. I had some good feedback from that event last time it was run.
Yeah.
So if you're around in Manchester on the 2nd of April, it's only a month away, get along there and take part.
The next event we've got is from the 11th to the 15th of April, and it's Ubuntu App Developer Week. We'll put a link in the show notes. And what's all this about then? I should know this.
It's a week to develop apps.
It's sessions aimed at enabling and inspiring developers to write applications that scratch their itches. So I think this is part of the whole initiative to try and show off Ubuntu as a good development platform.
Yes, it's getting
get people jump-started.
Excellent. And there's presumably IRC sessions and all that sort of stuff going on. And there's a wiki page, which we'll link to in the show notes, that you can find out more. And another promo to play this time. This is from the Indiana Linux Fest, which is happening on the 25th to 27th of March. So not very long. In fact, just 3 weeks just or so away. If you're in Indiana or can get out there, maybe you should go along and listen.
Saludos y saludos. This is Riclaudio Montalban, brother of Ricardo. If you are like me, you enjoy the finer things in life, like cars, Corinthian leather, and Linux Fests. Join Indiana Linux Fest, one of the finest Linux Fests, as they begin their march to freedom. From the 25th to the 27th, events include LPIC exam cram class, LPIC and PSDA certification exams, Fedora Activity Day, as well as the second Drupal Camp Indie Community Driven Talks.
plus performances by Dual Core, Shamers, and Left Hand. Keynote speakers include Tarus Baylog of OpenNMS and Bradley M. Kuhn, Executive Director of the Software Freedom Conservancy. They are also still looking for volunteers and sponsors. So, if you are interested, go to IndianaLinux.org to learn more. That's IndianaLinux.org. Now that is what I call fine Corinthian leather.
That is bonkers.
That was an accent. I'm not too sure where from, but it was an accent.
So, back in the UK, OggCamp.
Yes.
It's happening.
Yes. Oh. And we'll have more details when the venue is booked. And
somewhere.
Coming soon to somewhere near us.
Yes, because it's easier that way.
Yeah, so stay tuned and listen to us and the Linux Outlaws guys to find out more.
And our first command line love for 2011 comes from listener Russ Phillips, who says, after listening to the last episode of Season 3 and hearing about how Alan had to change lots of passwords, I finally got around to changing some of mine. In doing so, I came up with a command line love. And we'll put the command in the show notes. And I believe it's to basically generate a random password of characters and so on.
Yeah, it uses the system dictionary user share. User share dict words, that's the one. It can come up with some really kind of weird and wonderful combinations. It sort of cuts things up and makes strange things.
Is it like chop two words together or something, or mix and match? Because the words kind of look like words, but not quite.
Something. Yeah.
Like one of them that I had was zoo geographical. Ooh. But then I also got pig-headed.
Maybe this was made just for you, Alan. I don't know.
My special dictionary.
Yeah.
It's quite handy, actually. But I don't know. Aren't you supposed to not use dictionary words for passwords? Isn't that like the general received?
If you're using just a dictionary word. But I guess you
use it as a base.
The longer it is and the more complex it is, and the fact if it's not, cat or dog, which are also dictionary words, if it is zoological, it's going to be orders of magnitude more difficult to guess.
The point at which you have to come up with a unique password, your mind just goes completely blank of any real words ever anyway.
Well, what I did was type pwgen space 8 space 1, and you get an 8-character password that's just a jumble of letters and numbers, and all of my passwords are now generated via pwgen, because I always have a shell open somewhere and I just switch to a terminal and go pwgen 8-1, there's my new password, and then I have to record that somewhere, which I write on a post-it note and stick it next to my screen.
Absolutely.
Fail safe.
Excellent. Well, give that one a go if you want to find out if you want to generate some weird and wonderful passwords.
And that's what we're
in keeping with the tradition of other UK broadcasters, we try to educate, entertain, and inform.
Oh.
But instead of that, we're having a quiz.
Ah.
Each time we run a quiz, one of us is going to come up with questions to pose to the other presenters of the show. You can feel free to join in by shouting out the answers wherever you're listening. Or if you're listening live, see if you can beat the other listeners to the answers in the IRC channel. Yes, Laura?
Do we have to do that homework, or could we contract it out to listeners?
I'll mention that at the end.
Okay.
Good question. Thanks for that. You don't get any points. In the studio in front of us, we have a state-of-the-art 3D holographic display showing the numbers, 1 to 20. I'll go around the team getting them to pick a number, which will reveal a question and a picture. I'll then read that to them, and if they come up with the right answer with no help from the other presenters or the internet, then they get points. Up to 5 points per question. So if you've ever seen the BBC's A Question of Sport, the picture quiz, then that won't really help you very much, but it's a bit like that. Okay.
So texts off and phones out of your area, yes, and all that sort of stuff.
So you all turn off IRC and your search stuff and turn your screens away from you. And okay. If you could put your 3D glasses on now, cover your screen. There we go.
Oh, wow. Alan, you look more 3D now than you did before.
Thanks very much.
I keep hitting Alan's nose.
Oh, I wish the whole world was in 3D.
And they haven't even got their glasses on yet. So we'll start with Tony. So, Tony, okay. If you could pick a number from the 3D display.
I will pick number 11, please.
Number 11. So let's flip that over. And, oh, it's a picture of Simon. Simon Dunville sitting at home listening to the Ubuntu UK podcast live, wondering where it all went wrong.
Oh, aww. Bless him. Hi, Simon.
Hi, right. Si.
So, question 11. This is for Tony. No conferring.
I'm feeling the pressure now. Why do I have to go first?
Here you go. On a standard installation of Ubuntu, where on the file system would you find the kernel image you're running?
Which directory?
Yes.
Or folder, if you want to be Windows speaking.
I'll ask the question.
It's just killing time.
Slash boot. Correct.
Hey!
5 points for Tony.
Magic. 5 whole points.
Well done. Next is Laura's turn. So, Laura, pick a number. You'll notice that number 11 has disappeared from the 3D display.
Yes. A 5, then, please, Bob.
5. Right. Bob. Okay, 5. Let's turn that round.
Oh, my.
There's a picture of Graham Binns on a peach beach.
Oh, on a peach.
That's actually a better image, isn't
that
it?
That is.
Graham Binns on a beach polishing his lens.
Oh.
Magic. So, question number 5 for Laura.
Oh, my.
What is or was Grumpy Groundhog? Then you look at my screen.
Is it a wannabe Ubuntu distribution that never was?
Is that your final answer?
Yes.
I'm afraid it's not. I'll throw it open to the other guys. Grumpy Groundhog. What Grumpy is Groundhog. Or was Grumpy
I thought
Groundhog?
It was going to be the what became Breezy Badger, but then they decided to use the name for something else which never emerged.
I'm afraid that's wrong.
Oh, well.
I was going to say, because that's The Sims, what I said.
Yeah. Okay, the answer is it was a bleeding edge version of Ubuntu that never materialized. It was aimed to produce an Ubuntu-derived distribution containing the crack of the day of the set of packages. So like Debian Experimental, that right. kind of thing. No right. points, I'm afraid, there, Laura.
That's harsh.
Yeah. Well, she didn't get it right. It's my quiz.
Can I press it on the screen?
No, I know it feels 3D, but you can't press it. Mark.
Have a vowel, please, Carol.
One from the bottom. What number would you like?
It's a family show.
Choose from the 3D display.
Have number 18, please.
Number 18. Okay, number 18. Let's turn that round. Oh, it's a picture of Eric Raymond polishing his gun.
What's a polishing going on?
Yes. Question 18. What's the name? This is for Mark. What's the name of the community website where Ubuntu users can contribute ideas for improving Ubuntu?
Was that the Ubuntu Brainstorm?
Yes, it is. Ooh, yeah, 5 points to Mark. Well done. Back to Tony. Tony, can you pick a number from the 3D display?
I will go with number 1, please.
Number 1 for Tony. So, Tony, what's behind this one? Oh, it's a picture. Oh, it's Paul Sladen riding a Brompton through a hotel lobby.
Oh, hi, Paul.
Oh, lovely. Question 1 for Tony. Name all of the officially blessed Ubuntu distros and derivatives.
Oh, come on. Well, as in Ubuntu.
Yep, Kubuntu, as in Ubuntu.
As in Ubuntu, Kubuntu, Zubuntu, Edubuntu, and there's 5, are there?
I missed that one off, but I'm not.
Okay.
Go on. There's 2 more.
I wish to appeal on the grounds of.
Unlucky.
As in, are currently officially blessed, if you like.
Yeah.
There's Ubuntu Server.
Not really.
Okay.
Derivatives.
All right, derivative. As in, canonical approved derivatives.
As in, right, okay. So they're built on canonical infrastructure, canonical ship licenses.
That's what I'm getting at. Yeah. Mythbuntu.
Yes.
And there's one more, and it is. Hopefully there are people at home shouting at their computers right now.
Yeah, probably nothing to do with this. No. Just shouting.
Well, I got Edubuntu and you'd missed that one.
Yes, so that's fine. That's
okay, I'll let you have that. The one you missed, can anyone else remember? Anyone else know?
Setubuntu?
That's actually surprisingly not official.
You never know.
Ubuntu Studio.
Oh, Ubuntu Studio. Oh,
you even have apparel of Ubuntu Studio.
I do, yeah. I thought that would have stopped, but there we go.
Well, there you go. Okay, so...
he's harsh. Well, there you go.
Yeah, don't worry, you'll get your chance. Laura, back to the 3D display, if you could pick a number.
8, please.
Number 8. Okay, number 8. What have we got here? Oh, it's Fabian Scherschel exploding with rage.
Oh, hi, wow. Fab.
That's a really common picture. And that was number 8, wasn't it? So question 8 to Laura. Name the 5 main features of Launchpad.
Ooh.
What are the 5 things you do with Launchpad?
Raise bugs.
Bug tracker, yep.
Bug tracker. The community, you register your groups?
Do you
register That's not groups? One of the main features. That's kind of a side feature. I'm thinking of the main reason why Launchpad exists. What are the
tracking bugs.
Tracking bugs, yep, that's one.
Tracking bugs.
Yeah, you can keep on tracking bugs. Yeah.
Oh, it does something clever, supposedly, with upstream bug fixing.
Okay, aside from bugs.
Oh, we're not allowed to have bugs anymore.
Well, we can't have bugs 5 times to get 5 points, no. Something
what
else.
What does Launchpad do?
Yeah.
Other than track bugs?
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know it did anything except track
wow.
bugs.
Wow. Do you have a logon to Launchpad?
Yeah, I raise bugs.
That's not one of the questions, by the way.
Oh. I log in with the same ID as I use in the Canonical shop.
That's lovely, but that's not one of the things that's on my list. Shall I give it to you? You have 1 point. You're safe. You can take that
home. I get partial
points.
Can we steal?
You can take that home with you. Yeah, you can take up to 2 points.
Code
hosting, yes.
Yeah,
packaging? No, that's not really on Launchpad.
You mean PPAs?
Yeah, well, no, I was thinking of the building stuff.
Yeah, that is build service.
Oh, build
that's
service. Yes. I did know that, actually.
Yeah.
Any others?
There's the contribute masses of tons of CO2 to the environment feature.
Translations.
Right. Okay. Oh, yeah. Hurry, you guys. Translations. Mark got another one. Yes, translations. One more.
I thought that was just a group on it.
No idea.
Launchpad answers.
Answer tracker. Of course, yeah.
Remember that nobody uses?
That we use Stack Exchange for now.
Yes, exactly. That we use every other thing for. Yeah, absolutely. So 1 point to Laura for bugs, and bugs. 1 to Tony for code hosting and 2 to Mark for build service and translations. Magic.
Excellent.
So that was Laura's go. So it's Mark's turn.
Have number 10.
Number 10. Yes, that is available. So what's behind number 10? Stuart Langridge sitting on his own in a pub full of teenagers.
Oh, mine's a pint, Stuart.
What a lovely picture. Aww. Okay, so that's number 10. Question number 10. Stop looking at my screen. Okay, Mark.
Yes.
You've been given a computer to install Ubuntu on.
Right.
Name as many ways as you can to install Ubuntu. Not Kubuntu, Ubuntu.
Proper distro.
From a CD, from a DVD. From a USB stick, from an SD card, and from over a network.
Okay. Can we be more specific about any of these?
Well,
a 35.
So three of those were the same: a live CD, kind of on a CD, on a DVD, on a USB.
Okay. It could have come pre-installed.
Yeah, that's not happening, is it?
So, hold on. How many answers are we looking for here?
Well, I've got 5 here, but 5. You know, you could easily come up with extra ones I've not heard of. So you so far got a CD and a USB key,
and a net boot.
Net boot.
Yes.
Net boot. What? Yeah. How are you thinking? What? A server or?
Yes.
I'm giving you the answer. What am I doing? Yeah. Okay.
That's what I was thinking.
Right, keep it up.
Yeah, that's exactly what I wanted to do. Okay.
No, I think I might be out.
Okay, so 3 for Mark. Tony, have you got any extras? Or Laura? Laura.
Alternate CD.
Alternate CD. You saw that on my screen.
No.
Okay.
Ruby.
Wooby. Oh, Wooby, yeah. Yeah, Wooby. Wooby. Yeah, one for Tony.
Thank you.
Yay. 2 points.
The other ones I had, so I don't know, NetBoot, Pixie Boot as well, two different things.
Oh, I thought they were the same thing.
Well, network image is a small ISO image.
You know? Oh, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So you install over the network.
No, I was thinking Pixie Boot, but I called it NetBoot.
And the other one was a clone of another machine. Yeah, something like that. Clonezilla or something like that. Yeah.
Mm. Oh, yeah, okay.
Anyway, Tony, I think it's your turn, Tony.
I will have number 14, please, Davina.
Number 14. My name is Davina. Right, let's flip that round and see what's... Ah, it's Matt Ooh. Assay.
Yeah, and he's getting close to some customers, by the look of it.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, wow. Haven't seen that before. Number 14.
Yes.
Tony.
Yes.
Name three applications commonly used to capture or view content from a webcam.
Cheese.
Yes.
Webcam.
Yes.
Akiga.
Ooh, good call.
Hang on.
Yeah. Bonus, can you think of any more?
Skype.
Yeah, go on.
And I don't know.
Okay. Anyone else got any?
Kazam.
Is that the KDE one?
No, that's the screencasting one made by the guy who made that.
It doesn't really do webcams, though, does it?
Oh, sorry. Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I don't know what I was thinking. Yeah.
Sorry.
No, I have no idea. I just said Skype.
Okay, so 4 points to Tony. The other two that I had here, Zor TV, XAW TV.
Okay.
And Motion. The motion tracking webcam thing. Yeah.
Good call.
Good. Four to Tony. Was that four? Yeah, you came up with four.
Yeah, I came up with four.
Yeah, that was right.
five.
Running out of time here, so we'll have to hurry you. Laura, can you find another number on the big screen of doom?
20, please.
20. Okay, let's have a look. Let's flip that round. And, Anna Nelson, automating the automation of her documentation.
Oh, bless her. Look at her go.
Number 20. Okay, Laura. Number 20. What's the name of the general interest mailing list started before Ubuntu had a name?
I have no idea.
No idea at all?
Not at
all. We have mentioned it a couple of times on the show.
Yeah, we have.
I clearly wasn't listening.
Okay, no problem. Can I, Tony or was Mark, it, can you steal?
Was the SSSD?
SSS.
Shuttleworth Secret Debian Derivative thing.
SSDD.
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay.
No. Mark?
Nope, not a clue.
It's called Sounder.
Oh, right.
Okay. I've never heard of that.
It's fun. You should check it out.
Yeah, it's awesome. round to Mark.
It's the last one, I
can
think.
Can you pick your last one from the laser display screen, or whatever it is we're calling it?
3D holographic display.
That's the one.
Of doom. I will have number 13.
Number 13. Okay, 13. Let's have a look. Oh, ooh, that's an unusual picture. It's Richard Stallman browsing the web.
Ooh, that's very rare.
Yeah, it is. We'll keep that one.
And he's using Internet Explorer.
Unbelievable. Question 13. Mark.
Yes.
What ghost loaned his name to the loopback live image on the Ubuntu CD?
Funny you should ask that. Casper?
Yes.
Oh, yes.
Excellent.
Right, okay. Well,
Yes.
I said, have you got time to toss up the scores?
I have, if you give me 5 minutes to add them up, and we'll have them by the end of the show.
Okay, all right. So we'll catch that in the outro then.
Yes.
Excellent. Right, well, let's get on with the next thing.
And now it's time for the bit about Ubuntu.
Yeah, the first thing in the bit about Ubuntu this week is the Ubuntu Manual Project, which is looking for a project leader and an editor-in-chief.
Yes.
Is this to help kind of keep it going?
Yeah, because, you know, Benjamin's been busy with other stuff, so he stepped down. They're now looking for people to do editing and a new
leader. This is the user-facing manual, isn't it?
Yeah, the PDF. That is nice and friendly and easily downloadable.
Okay, well, we'll put a link in the show notes if you're interested in helping out. Click on that.
Phil Bull has blogged about his frustration with the GNOME Ubuntu relationship.
Yeah, it's interesting because he was giving a talk and...
Shuttleworth turned up.
Yes.
How cool is that?
In a mask. What's his name?
Reagan mask?
Cruise?
No, the other guy from Star Wars. Darth Vader, that's the one. Right. He turned up in a Darth Vader mask and sat in the audience and nobody knew it was him until he took the mask off. Someone asked him.
He probably fitted in quite well wearing a Star Wars mask in the audience at a geek event.
Yeah, absolutely.
Fantastic. How bizarre. Yeah. He could be here now.
It's really...
he could be that cat.
Wearing a Laura mask. It's worth a read. Actually, it's worth a read about the relationship. It's really good.
Cool.
Canonical and Banshee have had a little bit of a set too. It's caused a bit of a stir in the community around the affiliate fees from Banshee's Amazon MP3 store. And there's quite a lot of stories about this. Yes. Lots of people talking about this.
Yes, if you listen to the Linux Action Show or been on Twitter and seen some of the rage that's been flying around. Mm. So let me get this right. Previously, Banshee had an affiliate scheme, which means if you bought songs through Banshee,
from Amazon MP3.
From Amazon MP3, the credit for it, a bit of cash went to the GNOME Foundation.
Yes, all of it.
And now, 100% of the cash, but not 100% of the fee, yeah. Yes. But now Canonical are taking 75% of that in the new version of Ubuntu.
Yeah, the version that ships with Ubuntu.
Yeah.
So if you get your Banshee with Ubuntu, then the affiliate fees is split 75 Canonical, 25 GNOME Foundation, and Canonical are adding 25% of the Ubuntu or Music Store to the GNOME donation as well.
Okay, so it's take with one hand, give with the other to some
people.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Is this really a good thing or a bad thing? Lots of people are getting a feeling that they're ripping off the GNOME Foundation and this isn't going to help relationships between Ubuntu and GNOME.
Yeah, it's a bit of a PR disaster for Canonical, really, the way they went about it.
Did it just appear in the code? Somebody noticed it in a comment?
No, they had a conversation with the Banshee guys. They had a conference call with the Banshee guys, developers, and had a discussion about the options and then called them back later and said, actually, we've changed our mind. We're going to give you a different option. And this is the option that we're going to use. So I think at least it's a PR disaster. At most, it's... a bit rude but perfectly within the license under which Banshee is distributed. Yeah. You can change it. You could change the name, you could change all kinds of things about it, and they happen to change the affiliate.
Yeah.
It's a tricky one.
Yeah. Certainly not, as you say, certainly not good PR. Mm.
And the last bit about Ubuntu is an Ubuntu mascots wallpaper, which I believe has been updated.
Mm.
Yeah, John Spriggs tweeted this earlier.
Yes.
And it's got all of the sort of cartoon versions of all the mascots from Warty Warthog all the way through to whatever the latest
Natty
one is.
Narwhal.
Yes, the thing with a spike on its head isn't a unicorn. And it's kind of nice. And I think it's sort of quite sweet to see them all there. And I was struggling to go through them, remembering what they all were. I got the early ones and I got the late ones and got lost in
them. Funny, that was one of the quiz questions.
I think it's a bit creepy and depressing. They're all just sort of abandoned on a shelf, looking quite forlorn.
Yeah, it's quite dull colours as well, very brown, you know.
Yeah, but it's kind of styled.
Yeah, I mean, I do quite like it. I can see why Mark thinks it's a bit,
dull.
Yeah.
It's a bit bagpuss, isn't it?
Yeah.
It is. There's one left on the shelf.
And new in this season, we're going to introduce the Not About Ubuntu, a chance to talk in slightly more depth about some of the stories that have cropped up in the last week or so that aren't about Ubuntu. Yes, there are some. And the first one is that contributors to Fedora and OpenSUSE have put efforts to port Unity to these distributions on hold due to time constraints.
Mm.
Yeah, I guess they were trying to keep up with the Ubuntu goodness or whatever. And
I wouldn't be surprised if sometime later they appear in the various repositories for other distros. But at the moment, it's really fast moving.
And it just sounds like the developers who are working on it in the respective distros just don't have time to do it themselves. So they just said, not doing it for now.
Yeah,
chasing a moving target's always hard, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't think it's anything, against Unity. I don't think anyone doesn't want to have Unity. I'm sure there are plenty of people who don't want Unity, but what I'm saying is I don't think the distros are vetoing having Unity in their repositories.
No, it just sounds like when it's a bit more stable, we'll get onto it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Cool, fair enough.
Crunchbank has released version 10, codenamed Statler, the first stable release of the distro since... that's been based on Debian.
Yeah, they switched from Ubuntu to Debian.
And it's on Debian Stable, the new Debian 6.
Oh, wow. Okay.
That's really good.
Because the new Debian was released, was it 14th of February?
Yeah, not long ago.
Yeah, a couple of weeks ago.
Oh, it was Fosdem weekend, wasn't it?
Yes, it was, yes. And Valentine's Day weekend, because they released on 14th of February.
I don't know much about that.
they did it 2 years ago. They released on the same weekend. But the interesting thing was that Statler, the Crunch Bang release, was in beta, or first beta, at Ogcamp last year.
Yeah.
Which was May. So it's been quite a gestation period for Phil and his colleagues to get that up and running and out the door. But congratulations for so doing.
And I've stuck it on an EPC and it works really nicely.
Excellent.
It's really sweet. And it's got some extra nice features, like when you first install it, just after you've installed the first logon, it takes you through in a console screen. So it's not pretty, but it's functional, asking you, do you want the codecs? Do you want Java? Do you want Flash? Oh. Do you want these things? Mm. Do you want Dropbox installed? And you say yes. And it installs Dropbox for you. You don't have to go off and get the dev or anything like that. It's really sweet. It's got some nice features, and it's quick on low-spec hardware.
Excellent.
Nice.
There's an article on Linux Weekly News about Red Hat beginning to release its kernel source packages without separating out the patches to the upstream code. This has apparently been done on the orders of Red Hat CEO Jim Whitehurst in an attempt to make life harder for Oracle to repackage Red Hat's modifications for their unbreakable Linux, which are based on Red Hat.
Yeah, so I'm not sure I quite understand how it's making life difficult for them.
So normally, if you get your kernel from kernel.org, that's a pristine kernel. If you get your kernel from your distro, you end up with a kernel and then a big fat bundle of patches, individual patches, which you can then pick out and choose which ones to apply. Or you could, if you are a downstream, you could take that kernel and then remove certain patches if they're not appropriate for your user base. But what Red Hat are doing is just lumping it all in one great big tarball and saying, that's the kernel source code. Figure it out yourself. You know, it's like, it's the equivalent of taking you know, a jar full of 10 pence pieces, dropping it on the floor and saying, there's your change. You know, it's kind of,
okay,
it's there, but you really have to pick it out and there's bits of broken glass in there.
So I guess when they're, nice. I guess when they are basing it on Red Hat, they're not just literally taking it and recompiling it. They're obviously adding their own modifications, Oracle.
They may well be, yes. I mean, they might be adding enterprisey features for their database, or one of the things they will be doing is stripping out the logos, because obviously they're all trademarked Red Hat, in the same way that CentOS do.
Presumably your logos wouldn't be in the kernel.
Well, there will be trademarks, I would imagine, in that package somewhere. Mm. Maybe.
Yeah, okay. And sorry, I'm wrestling with a cat here. And that's all in the Not About Ubuntu this time. it's all going so well.
And it's time for the feedback. Brilliantly, people kept emailing us and commenting on the website and things while we were away over winter.
That is brilliant.
We have some feedback. First up, a developer emailed us on podcast@ubuntu-uk.org about our various discussions, probably over various episodes, about bugs not getting resolved. He says,
I work on two different free software applications, one as my day job and one at night. In my fun project, we receive a lot of bug reports, but most are useless. Few people include enough information for me to guess even to begin where to look. It's not very enjoyable trying to coax information out of people, so I pretty much ignore them unless they're obvious. There are bugs sitting in there from 5 years ago. In the software I hack on for my day job, we have thousands of bugs each month. Most of them are useless in their original state, but there's a small group of people in the company who get paid to triage those bugs and turn them into a single useful bug report. There are no bugs currently in our system over 1 month old that haven't been resolved in some way. Both of these projects are 100% free software, GPL version 2 or above. Good software isn't cost-free. We can either make it good by spending time making good bug reports and triaging bugs, writing documentation and nice artwork, or you pay someone to care about your software. That's a fair point.
Yeah.
And obviously that's what organisations like Canonical do when they're employing developers to work on those projects. It is to, in theory at least, get a good response time to critical issues that come up. And you pay them for that privilege if you've got a support contract. But I don't know. The balance seems to have shifted from a time where perhaps more people who were using free software could actually fix the free software as well, because there was a lot of system administrators and developers using it, to now a larger proportion of users without that level of skill. And I think that's something that the free software community has struggled to come to terms with over the last 2 or 3 years.
I think you also need the balance as well, though, because the community is providing free testing that you're not having to pay for in raising the bugs. And so they need to feel that there's a certain amount of return on that investment.
Yeah,
and I think there's a lot of people that don't feel that at the moment.
Yeah, fair enough. MG left a comment on our website at podcast.ubuntu-uk.org about training people in desktop Linux skills.
In the city where I live, I don't think there are any providers of desktop training for Linux. You can take courses locally on Linux server administration, but for normal office use, you're on your own. Our IT department don't realistically have the time or experience to handle it. Canonical has training partners set up, but they appear to be oriented towards IT departments to set up and maintain the systems. That's essential, but doesn't address the sort of training that normal office workers could use. We're not talking about how to set up servers. We're talking about how to use OpenOffice, send emails, or copy files.
Okay, so the feedback we got over Christmas was a bit depressing.
Yes.
I believe there are companies who do things like there are OpenOffice partners, aren't there, who do OpenOffice training. But I'm not sure that there's... I've heard of companies that do the whole shebang in terms of how to use desktop Linux.
I guess you've got to have the market. Yeah. I mean, there are online training companies like, I think there's a company called Lynda that do online screencasts, and there you pay for those. Mm. But it seems there's a gap in the market there, but is the market big enough?
Yep, good question.
Regular feedbacker, Sorin, emailed us to say,
I just had a look at Gnome Shell and it's crap, so I have to apologise for being so harsh on Unity, though I still don't like it.
Fair enough.
That's a first for Sorin, isn't it? Apologising for something?
And also a two-line email as well.
Yeah. Or was it heavily edited down, Laura?
It was genuinely 2 lines.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well done, Sorin.
Thanks, Sorin. And finally, some feedback on our end of season panto. First up from Andrew, who left a comment on our website.
Great last show, guys. Special thanks to Simon, and I wish him well. One question, though. Why did Alan's accent go from English to Australian to South African?
That is a good question.
Who knows? Yeah. I travel around a lot.
One of life's mysteries.
Oh, I should be talking now. Robin Catling of the Full Circle podcast sent in a review of the panto that he found in the New Milton Advertiser, sponsored by Balmer's Patent Bunion Cure.
UUBC in Panto in... I'm sorry, I'll read that again. UUPC Triumph in Panto Season by Wing Commander Sir Arthur Curmudgeon, retired. Having just listened to the UK Loco Amateur Dramatic Society Christmas Entertainment, a rousing version of Jack and the Beanstalk, I felt compelled to put pen to paper before my medication takes effect. I may even write something on it. In keeping with tradition, Ms. Laura Cowan played the principal boy with aplomb, which Mama says got me quite overexcited, and I believe I recognised Terry Jones as the pantomime dame. The full acting honours, however, must be awarded to Mr. Simon Dunville for his rendition of Daisy the Cow. I've never heard such emotional range in animal impersonations, from curiosity to fear to joy to pathos. His mooing was truly pathetic. This was a rather modern rendering of a panto classic, which seemed to include several in-jokes, at which Mama and myself were left somewhat bemused. The giant appeared to be based on an actual personage from an unidentifiable country, which I thought might be dangerous to the player's health. I await with interest their forthcoming production of Beckett's Waiting for Godot. Faithfully, the WC.
What a nutter.
Well, thank you very much for that review, Robin, and for making some of those words very difficult to say. You wouldn't think I had actually practiced that.
Thanks for all your feedback, everyone.
Yes.
Yes, indeed. Okay, well, that's all we have time for in this episode. One of the interesting things about doing this live is just the little things that you don't quite get right.
And the lack of time you have to tot up the scores.
Yes.
So we're going to find out these scores later.
Yes.
I really want to know.
I won.
Oh, right. Alan is the winner.
Pretty sure I didn't.
So there'll be a coming up on Twitter?
Yes. We'll put it out on the UPC Twitter feed.
Okay. Excellent. I await that with bated breath. Well,
thanks for listening, everyone. You can find out how to get in touch with us on our website, podcast.ubuntu-uk.org, including voicemail numbers and Twitter feeds, Facebook and IRC channels. Let us know what you think of the show. Give us your thoughts about Ubuntu and the community around it.
Yes.
And relax.
And we'll join us
next time.
Indeed. Yes. We'll be back in 2 weeks' time at the same time, 8:30 in the evening, UTC. Remember the local time zones. And
who would forget?
Absolutely. And we hope you'll join us there and that you've enjoyed this live show or downloaded it via the website on the normal means. We'll see you in 2 weeks. Thanks for listening.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.